Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's weekly media roundtable. Students across the country say this is just the beginning. Over the past week, they have changed the conversation around gun control by demanding real action. They have also exposed politicians who accept millions of dollars from the National Rifle Association. So how have they affected the coverage? Joining us is Elizabeth Van Brocklin, staff reporter at The Trace, an independent nonprofit news organization dedicated to expanding coverage of guns in the United States. Elizabeth covers urban violence, including the experiences and needs of gunshot survivors, something that deserves far more attention. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
And we're kicking off today's show by discussing coverage of the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Syria, which is taking a devastating toll on children. Over 400 people, including more than 50 children, have been killed in eastern Ghouta this week. Joining us to discuss coverage is Alia Malik, an award-winning journalist and civil rights lawyer. Alia is author of The Home That Was Our Country, a memoir of Syria. It tells the rich history of Syria through the history of her family. Hi, Alia, welcome back to the show. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be back with you.
It's great to have you, Alia. As we always do on Your Call's Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So, Elizabeth Van Brocklink, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
This week, actually, in the past week, have been following... There was a great piece by Kevin Rector at the Baltimore Sun. He actually wrote an op-ed, but he covers crime and violence in Baltimore. And his piece was basically talking about how there are a lot of young people in the city of Baltimore who deal with gun violence every day. And while it's really important to be listening to the Parkland students, there are some other young people that have been talking about this and... really enduring a lot. So I thought that was a good piece.
Yes. I mean, it's a very good angle. In fact, later in the show, I'd like to ask you about that because you write extensively about communities across the country who have dealt with gun violence and they don't get as much attention. So I'm glad you brought that up and we'll put a link at our website right after the show. What about you, Alia? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I feel like you should have given me advance warning about that. I mean, I follow Syria, so it's not been such a great week to watch the news. I did read that Baltimore Sun piece that Elizabeth is talking about. I'm from Baltimore. I tweeted it out earlier in the week, and I'm glad she brought it up. I think it sort of underlies that we kind of have to have empathy for children who are living in danger and in fear everywhere, as opposed to sort of a hierarchy of who we are able to empathize with. I thought what I found interesting was speaking of young people, there is this Syrian kid in the Ghouta, Muhammad Najim, who has sort of taken to being a citizen journalist. And I've been watching his dispatches that he sort of films on his own from the Ghouta. So I would encourage people to check him out and see what he has to say about what's going on. It's sort of like the perfect convergence of kids and sort of showing agency and sort of engaging the issues that are shaping their lives.
Hmm. You know, since you both brought up these stories, let's dive in and talk about that because, I mean, there are connections when you look at children who are being killed in Syria and then children who are being shot and sometimes killed here in the United States. Who does get the media attention? You often see these profiles about someone overcoming something or, you know, kids who are getting on buses and going to D.C. But as you said, Elizabeth, what about the kids in Baltimore who have been dealing with gun violence? How does the media, you know, cover them? So, Elizabeth, what are your thoughts about the role of journalists and the decisions they make in terms of what stories they tell and the angles that they choose to focus on?
You know, The Trace does cover whenever there's one of these active shooting, mass shooting events that draw national coverage. Of course, we are paying attention to that and following it as we have for the past week and a half. But part of our mission is also to shed light on the sort of other type, you know, the other gun violence. It's been described to me as a mass shooting in slow motion by another journalist I know. So my coverage of gunshot survivors, I guess, you know, it's not that calculated, but I try to reflect, I guess, the proportion of what actually happens in America. Mass shootings are horrifying, and they also account for such a small percentage of gun violence that happens every day. So I spend a lot of time talking to people who have maybe never talked to a journalist before. They're not really even, they always know, like, how journalism works, and so that's also an interesting experience. But I try to get in touch with people who are just living this on a daily basis and have, you know, dozens of friends who they know who have been impacted, or they've lost multiple family members, they've been shot themselves.
I notice in your pieces, Elizabeth, in almost every piece, there's a section that says, "Are you a gunshot survivor?" More than 100,000 people are hit by a bullet every year. Most live. If you're one of them, we want to hear your story. I mean, 100,000 people are hit by a bullet every year in the United States.
Yeah, most of the people, even though that the coverage does tend to focus on the deaths, and I think we are seeing this in Parkland, but I've been trying to keep an eye on the, you know, what we know so far about the wounded survivors. There's been a lot about kids who are at the school. Of course, they're leading this really remarkable movement, but I'm kind of looking out for what starts to come out about the people who are still recovering in the hospital or who have gone home. I'm sure they want privacy right now, which is understandable, but we know so little about what actually happens to people long-term who have these injuries, because there's so little data on it. But that 100,000 number, yeah, the vast majority of those people survive. We have, I think, the CDC's like latest count is 84,000 non-fatal gunshot injuries for 1 year. Wow. So there's a lot.
Elizabeth Van Brocklink is a staff reporter at The Trace. They are dedicated to expanding coverage of guns in the United States. Alia Malik is an award-winning journalist and civil rights lawyer. She's been on the show many times talking about Syria. And a very general question for you, Alia, along the same lines. What I notice in the, you know, the New York Times, Washington Post, when I read those papers, is you will read about a Syrian who got out of Syria and maybe made it to Germany and is now doing something extraordinary. And the report focuses on that specific person and how they got there and what they're doing now. But what really strikes you about how the national media, especially in the U.S., covers or doesn't cover Syrians?
You know, I get asked that question a lot. The thing is, I think it's a lot. It's seriously heavy lifting to ask journalists in an 800-word article to, you know, fill in readers or viewers or listeners into a situation that has its own context and people that have their own context and their own history when we haven't been paying attention all along. And so, you know, it's very, I think a lot of, I don't think the problem is necessarily on the journalist side as much as it's, I think readers find the Syria story really inaccessible and intimidating and hard to understand. And there's been a lot of effort at sort of obfuscating what is going on. There's been a lot of, you know, people who have different kinds of political agendas who, you know, want to sort of push, you know, an anti-interventionist or an anti-imperialist agenda, which is not in and of itself a bad agenda to push. But in doing so, sort of, I think are making it harder for Americans, people who don't know who don't know the region well, to understand exactly what's going on. And so somehow we sort of end up in this situation where people think these are two, you know, equally situated forces battling out. And of course they're going to be victims because of that. But why is that really my problem? And it's very hard to sort of, you know, you have to kind of go back to before this all started. And the sad reality is that we sort of only pay attention to people from other places when there's a crisis and it makes a headline. And at that point, it's really hard, I think, to catch somebody up completely. I mean, in the defense of those people who have been, you know, covering this story on a daily basis for 7 years, it also takes a toll on them. Mm. And it's very difficult when you are interviewing sources who are under siege and you're sort of doing it from the comfort of your, you know, bureau in Beirut. And I think sometimes we see the stories about the diaspora a little bit more because they're easier to get access to. And now this is a part of the Syrian story. Like, what happens when half a population of a country is displaced? Mm. A lot of it internally displaced, but a lot of it externally displaced as well. And this is, you know, this is why when I finally felt like I had to write a book on Syria, because there's no way for people to kind of enter it now, 7 years into this conflict, without also understanding, you know, how we got here. And it sort of took us 100 years to get here. And I think that's a reflection, a little bit of like Americans' distaste for history. We don't have much of a appetite for our own history. We are like still debating whether that, you know, this country was founded on genocide and slavery. Then how are we really going to get people to look at the, you know, the history of another country and sort of tune into it and start to think about it? Well, we can't even do that for ourselves and for our fellow Americans here. Hmm.
Well, luckily, we actually have time. I mean, we would need to have you on for an hour to really go into the history. We've done that before with you.
Yeah, we have,
but,
yeah.
But for, so, for example, Eastern Ghouta is getting a lot of attention because of the devastation. At least 500 people have been killed, at least 50 children. The photos have been horrific. So now this is leading the news. But as you said, there's missing context. So what would you add to the story that we're getting about Eastern Ghouta?
Well, so, you know, here we are talking about Syria again. It's basically been since the last chemical attack, I think, since there was a ton of attention. So, yes, there is an uptick of violence right now. But, like, what I think people don't realize is the Syrian regime's, you know, primary and preferred tactic of both consolidating its rule and legitimizing its rule is the use of violence. Violence is sort of the tactic that they used to come to power in 1970. So, yes, we're talking about, you know, people who have been subjected to state violence since 1970. We're just paying closer attention now. So, like, the idea that, you know, something's going to happen now, or that all of a sudden we might be able to shame the regime into not using violence is kind of, you know, I think this is, I mean, this is naive. Because the regime has been able to, like, have this escalation of violence from the kind of normal political violence that you know in authoritarian states, of disappearing people, arbitrarily detaining them, you know, and usually civil society, right, you know, the kind of people who just dissent or are dissidents, to now the sort of, like, more visual aerial bombing and chemical weapons and these siege tactics. But this is just an uptick. Right? This has sort of been a constant. So I guess the question to us is, why do we tune in now, and what do we think we're going to get out of it? And why do we think that the regime would change its behavior when it's been able to do this unfettered and with impunity for 7 years in plain sight in front of all of us? And so, you know, I appreciate that we're all talking about this again, but yesterday I was on a show where somebody was just trying to appeal to the world's humanity. And I just, you know, I think at this point, those appeals are not going to really get us very far. We cannot even in this country see the humanity of people who we've been, you know, who we don't think of it, or we think of as other than us. And I think it is, you know, my only, to kind of be a little bit hopeful, my only hope is that, like, this generation, these kids that we saw down in Florida, sort of saying, no, we're not going to do business as usual. We're not going to turn a blind eye. We're not going to accept polite political speak. And we are going to be confrontational. And one can only hope that sort of that's contagious, and that maybe can infect the generations, you know, those of us who are currently in power, but that maybe things can change down the road, because this is business as usual. We don't, you know, I know we love to give ourselves Academy Awards for movies about bravery and resilience in the wake of World War II and the genocides that were committed then, but that's not really who we've been in the last 20 years. I mean, this country is not at all held itself accountable for what has happened, for its involvement in the Middle East and what has happened there. And, you know, I think that it's down from there. I don't know how you're going to get people to tune into the situation now and think that we can do it. I mean, there's much that we can do, but I don't see the will to do it.
Like what?
I mean, for starters, this regime is backed. And I should just say, there is violence on two sides, right? But the principle violence is being committed by the regime. The one with the greatest control over the violence is the regime. And the regime has two principal backers, Russia and Iran. And these aren't pariah states. The United States has negotiated a nuclear deal with Iran. Russia, you know, it's going to require sort of confronting Russia and Iran and figuring out, negotiating a way to bring this to an end. But the world, international community has proven itself to not really be interested in confronting these powers. If people have embassies and ambassadors in other nations, where is the real pressure that is being put on them to put pressure on their, you know, the Syrian regime to stop this? and it's messy. You know, the United Nations and other humanitarian organizations, to be able to deliver humanitarian aid and to be able to do their work, have had to make deals with the regime, right? I mean, they've set up offices in Damascus now. These offices mean, I mean, it means that rents are going to the regime. So it, do they have any power to leverage? And, you know, maybe it means pulling out. I mean, you know, I'm not, this is not my, I'm a journalist. I can kind of report back. I can direct you to, the director of the Syria campaign wrote an entire list of things that, that could be done. I mean, from civil actions to protests to also like denormalizing the kind of language that we've gotten accustomed to and talking about bans on Syria. I mean, the next time we talk about a Muslim ban in this country or a ban on Syrians, why don't we have the conversation that how do we ask people who are in part, you know, living with the instability that was caused by an American invasion almost 20 years ago and American sort of interventions in the region, how are we asking them to, so we ask them to then also stay in place and die and take, you know, take the risks of living these lives, but then we tell them, and we, but we don't want them to be fundamentalists and we don't want them to carry weapons, but then when they try to flee or seek out a different life, we then ban them. I mean, there's this kind of thing, when these things get said, they shouldn't just be said with, you know, with our own complicity. Mm. I mean, it's such a big issue. I'm trying to answer the question for you, but it's large.
Right.
And it has to do with our moral failings. And the reality is, I just, maybe we're not as moralistic as we really think. Maybe it's not going to be until that next generation that's down in Parkland that's willing to sort of stand up and confront its leaders till we see something happen.
Alia Malik is an award-winning journalist and civil rights lawyer and author of The Home That Was Our Country, a memoir of Syria. It tells the rich history of Syria through the history of her family. And Alia will be with us for about 5 more minutes. If you have any questions or comments about coverage of Syria, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org or leave a comment on social media. Elizabeth Van Brocklink is a staff reporter at The Trace, an independent news organization dedicated to expanding coverage of guns in the United States. Alia, when you are invited to go on shows to talk about this issue, do you feel like U.S. reporters have a grasp of what's going on there? What do you think is missing?
You know, I mean, I think the people who are based in the region are doing good work. You know, here, do I think anchors on, I mean, you know, how well of a good grasp? I don't know, because it requires, I don't know how many people have a good grasp of what's going on in this country, let alone another country. What's missing is, you know, it's the same thing that happens with the U.S. And it's just, you know, we sort of get stuck in these conversations about the those who are trying to obfuscate, you know, what is happening. Did Russia interfere? Did Russia not interfere? You know, same with Syria. It's like we're asking, you know, were these chemical weapons really launched by the regime, or was it launched by Al-Qaeda pretending to be a regime to fool the entire international world? I mean, that discussion is kind of, you know, at some point, you know, I understand that we've all sort of been backed into this corner where we feel like we have to give both sides of an issue. Yes, there are different sides to debates, but sometimes there are things that are the truth. You know, we don't necessarily, you know, it's like having to debate climate change. I'm not interested in sort of having these discussions and these debates, and I think journalists here have been a little bit been forced into that corner. We saw Newsweek run 2 articles about, you know, by these basically what are truthers, you know, people sort of trying to say that the chemical attacks were not carried out by the regime. Mm-hmm. And we end up having to debate who carried out the chemical attacks while divorcing this from history. This is a regime that has consistently used violence. It is completely consistent with how it has ruled this country and how it has confronted opposition that it would continue to use violence of different sorts. And so, you know, always end up talking about the things that are, you know, I don't know if I made that point, made the point clear, but it is a heavy lift to ask of journalists to do all the work. I mean, at some point, there also needs to be leaders. And instead, last year when, you know, there was this discussion of whether or not people would take in Syrian refugees, you know, American governors and American mayors were, you know, fawning all over themselves to say, we won't be taking Syrian refugees. I mean, there were a few who did not react like that, but even my own, the governor of the state that I'm from, Maryland, you know, which is ostensibly a Democratic state, although he's a Republican governor, said that. And I'm a Syrian, you know, as if Syrians haven't been from Baltimore for generations. Mm-hmm. you know, so where is the political leadership? Where is someone willing to stand up and say that this is not who we are and this is not what we stand for? And I mean, I don't know how we're going to get that when we have a president calling for, you know, teachers to do arts and craft on their lunchtime and then, like, also be fully prepared to murder people. I mean, so we have a problem. We have a problem with leadership much more than just journalism.
And also social media feeds into what you just talked about. Elizabeth, we're seeing the same thing with students who are speaking out about last week's horrific shooting, where you have right-wing media and, you know, people on Twitter saying that these kids are actors and that they've been, that, you know, there's just a lot of trolling going around to the point where it has actually made it in the mainstream. So the Washington Post is now writing stories about how the right wing are saying some of these kids are actors staging events. How do you, as a journalist, deal with this? I mean, it was easy to ignore it a year ago, but now it's become very pervasive.
You know, this is not something that's new. After most mass shootings, there is a spate of all of these stories. People, it's actually, you know, hoaxers. This is a thing that one of my colleagues wrote a story about, where they were targeting a father of one of the Sandy Hook children who was killed, and that's a great piece if you are interested in kind of that history, because it's not a new thing. I have to say that I've found it enjoyable to watch these students from Parkland respond on Twitter. They just seem to not only do they not really speak in rhetoric, so they're cutting through a lot of that when they're arguing their points and leading this movement, but they also just seem to have kind of a good sense of humor about it. They don't get very riled up, and they just kind of throw it back in people's faces and even, like, take it to the next level. So to me, I'm watching them kind of take the power out of those theories and stories that say that they were crisis actors. They actually just don't seem too bothered by it. I read one thing that was saying they're, you know, they get together and they laugh about it. And so it hasn't really been hard. I haven't been covering them as individuals and needing to sift through that, because they're already doing that.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that more after a break. Alia, what are your thoughts about how people engage with Syria, about Syria and with Syrians on social media? What stands out for you?
I mean, social media is where a lot of these sort of, like, alternate truths started up. I mean, I'm not, you know, it's nice when you, yes, it is. It sometimes makes you feel good, and sometimes, you know, it's just ridiculous. Like, I started seeing, I feel like, the thing is, once that sort of cat is out of the bag, you cannot put it back in. And this is part of what happened in Syria. Like, very quickly, the regime sort of put out an alternate truth. Not so that you would believe, you know, propaganda isn't supposed to help you, isn't supposed to make you believe it, but it's supposed to make you not sure what to believe. And I think there are a lot of people who, here in this country, like, still believe, you know, Newton didn't happen. And those who, you know, are going to think these kids were actors are going to, I don't know that they'll ever see the proof that they weren't, or that they'll ever believe it, you know, that these are actually the kids. I mean, that is troubling to me. And I think a lot of these things sort of, like, fester in social media. And one of the things, just as a, you know, cautionary note, one of the things that the regime did, because I was in Syria when it all started in 2011, and one of the things that the regime did was right away, basically without using the words fake news, accused all the news reports of, you know, protests happening and then protesters being shot. They kept saying that this was, like, staged, this wasn't real, it wasn't true. They would show, you know, scenes from the same towns where they said, look how quiet it is. So, like, you know, this. But that's because they had their own state-controlled media, and so Syrians were able to choose their truth, right? And it is dismaying to see people here in the United States who don't have a state media, in theory, and who are able to sort of access different sources, also choosing their truths. And I don't know how you disavow folks of, you know, once they've taken these positions, how you disavow them of them. I just hope that group, those kids in Parkland and their peers across the country and across the globe, are more effective at it than, you know, those of us who are our age.
Well, it seems like they are. Alia Malik is an award-winning journalist and civil rights lawyer, author of The Home That Was Our Country, A Memoir of Syria. Alia, thank you for your work. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Coming up after the break, we'll continue our discussion with Elizabeth Van Brocklink, reporter with The Trace, about media coverage of the shooting, students, and so much more that's related to gun violence and violence in our culture. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, local public radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-TALK, 825-798-8255, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. The number to call again is 866-798-8255. Coming up at 11 and at noon, 2 hours of 1A from WAMU in Washington. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday's One Planet series, we will discuss water in California. Journalist Mark Arax has a very lengthy piece out about Stuart Resnick, one of the most powerful farmers in the U.S. and the largest single water user in the Western United States. How much of California's water does he control? And we're in the middle of a drought. Where does his water source come from? That is on Monday. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line. Your call at kalw.org. And if you have any questions or comments about media coverage, now we're going to spend the rest of the hour talking about the shooting, gun control, victims of gun violence. I mean, so many people who live to tell their stories are in desperate need of health care and therapy. And we're talking about that with Elizabeth Van Brocklink, staff reporter at The Trace, a nonprofit news organization dedicated to expanding coverage of guns in the United States. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment on social media. Elizabeth, we were talking about the students who have really changed the debate around gun control. In fact, today's New York Times top of the fold headline is "Why This Gun Debate Is Different from the Rest. Angry Teenagers Infuse a Stale Fight with New Passion." You know, as someone who covers urban violence and someone who covers the experiences and needs of gunshot survivors, what are your thoughts about how these students have changed the media coverage this time around? Elizabeth? Hi, go ahead.
Okay. As this shooting was happening and we were watching, you know, the tweets and the news articles started to come in 2 Wednesdays ago, it was already becoming apparent that this was different because the students were, many of them, recording things on their phone. So I think even from the actual event, it was there was something new here. These are teenagers, and this is right in like the social media era. It's different from other shootings, like Sandy Hook. The kids were too young to have phones. Virginia Tech, I think, it was too early for people just began, you know, recording on Snapchat, Instagram, live. You know, we have all this raw footage that came out of that. It's very horrific and also gives people, I think, a clearer sense than we'd ever had before of what it's actually like to experience this. Students sort of became reporters, and some of those people are now being outspoken, some of those teenagers. So I think that is something that's different. And you know, it is still early. It's only happened a week and a half ago, so I can't. I'm curious to know how this whole movement evolves. But we did have an interesting analysis. One of my colleague, Daniel Ness, who does amazing visuals for The Trace, he analyzed, I think, over 800 official statements from federal lawmakers since 2013, and kind of analyze the actual language that they were using. We hear these phrases like thoughts and prayers, common sense, gun reform. We wanted to see, like, how often do people actually say this, and is there a divide between Republicans and Democrats? And what Daniel found was that the Parkland shooting, the aftermath of this shooting, was the first time we have heard a Republican, Marco Rubio, Senator Marco Rubio, use the phrase gun violence. So that is a small example, but I think that it is telling, just in looking at the language, that there does seem to be a shift happening.
Well, as someone who specifically, I mean, this is your beat. You know, for a lot of reporters, they fly in and then they go home and talk about taxes and so many other issues, but this is your beat. So what really strikes you? Like, I was glued to the television on Wednesday during that CNN town hall, and I loved that these kids were asking more pointed questions of politicians than what I've heard on the radio and TV this week. I mean, we always follow the money on this show. Unfortunately, I don't think people in the media do a good enough job of that. We do a lot of shows about the NRA and funding. But to see a 17-year-old, Cameron Caskey, pointedly ask Marco Rubio if he's never going to take another dollar from the NRA ever again. I mean, he got $3 million just in 2016. And Rubio said, they buy into my agenda. He basically said, no, I will continue taking money. They're the ones that buy into my agenda. What really struck you about that exchange?
I think the thing that struck me about watching Cameron, but also all of these students, is they are very composed and they're very well-spoken, but I think they're also trying to keep it together. I mean, to me, that seems visually apparent, that I can just sense there's a lot of, there's understandably anger and rage, and they're doing a great job of channeling it, but I also find myself being curious about just the mental trauma that they've gone through. I'm sure that there are resources for them. Unfortunately, in a lot of other communities, that those resources aren't as clear for teenagers who go through gun violence, experience gun violence on a kind of a daily basis. But I guess I'm just kind of watching how they keep composed, but also, like, channel their emotions, and I'm curious what it's going to be like for them when there's, like, a quieter moment.
Right. Well, and in addition to this trauma, I mean, they're dealing with death threats. Cameron Caskey just said that he's leaving Facebook because he's dealing with so many death threats. Speaking of the trauma, Elizabeth, you know, I read a lot of your pieces yesterday, and I mean, I was in tears. The things that you write about are just so... They're much deeper than what we get in a lot of the news. A couple stories that you wrote about, listen as gunshot survivors in New Orleans open up about chronic pain and unequal medical care. And there's some clips with a number of mostly black men who have been shot in New Orleans, and they talked about what happened to them. Was health care available? Was therapy available? Can you talk a little bit about this? Because this is an angle that just doesn't get that much attention.
Yeah, sure. That piece was published in partnership with a great local media organization called The Listening Post, who actually did those interviews and recordings. One of those guys in particular, I just found his voice super compelling. His name was Roy. I think he was shot twice in totally separate incidents, 20 years apart. He really articulated just the in-the-dark feeling of going through this traumatic injury and then not having information given to him. Like, nobody really explained that he was going to, that he might go through symptoms of post-traumatic stress. No one pointed him directly to physical therapy, or for some reason he wasn't able to get physical therapy, and he walks with a limp right now. I think these shootings are always, like, very complex, because I want to follow them and I want to pay attention to this new fresh wave of survivors and victims, essentially. Yeah. But I also think about people who have kind of been going through this wear and tear of violence for decades, and just, you know, what life is like for them.
You also featured a man, Reginald Watson, who was shot in the leg one night in the early 90s on his way home from a parade. And years later, he was involved in a car accident that re-injured the same leg. He said, "I never had the same doctor. They kept switching up on me, and it became very frustrating." You also talked to people who just said, "I just wanted someone to talk to, and I didn't have that." How many people have access to the care that they need? According to your reporting, about one-third of hospitalized gunshot patients do not have health insurance.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how to calculate that because we don't even know how many shooting survivors there are. I mean, this is a problem for the trace as we try to, you know, work on this beat and chart these investigations. Some cities, do not even keep track of shooting victims. They certainly, they're keeping track of homicides, but the people who survive, we might not even have the numbers of them. So, like the denominator itself is we're not sure how many there are, but safe to say, you know, tens of thousands, probably more than a million in America. In terms of the people who don't have resources, I have noticed in my reporting, and I think this came up at the beginning of the show, was this kind of hierarchy of victims. Most gun violence occurs in low-income minority communities and neighborhoods where there are already not a lot of resources. So once this super traumatic injury happens to somebody, there just are not clear places, literal places or groups or even people that they can kind of go to and get connected to other resources for. We do have those kinds of things. Of course, there's a lot of gun violence that intersects with domestic violence, and we have clear, you know, there's a clear infrastructure of support for victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, for the young, the person most likely to get shot, there isn't that. Mm. So I can't put a number on it, but it seems like a lot.
You also ran a piece just recently, another incredible piece called "States Set Aside Millions of Dollars for Crime Victims, but Some Gun Violence Survivors Do Not Get the Funds They Desperately Need." Because so many people either have inadequate insurance or none at all, you quoted someone from the University of California, San Francisco's Trauma Recovery Center, Alicia Bacalari. She's a clinical psychologist. And she told you that victim compensation is set up to really help victims. And yet it's ironic because it really adds to the pain that they're going through. It puts a lot of expectations on them when they really have so few inner resources to deal with all of this. And sometimes the victim ends up feeling further victimized.
Yep, that was a piece I was working on for a number of months, talking to a lot of both gunshot victims, so people who had been directly shot and survived their injuries, and also family members of homicide victims who are also open to, you know, they can also apply for these funds. And the thing, one of the things I found was sort of pervasive lack of awareness and also just confusion about what these funds cover, who is eligible, where do you go to start an application, rumors about, you know, someone might hear that they wouldn't be eligible and not even try, when it's really up to the compensation programs to decide that, but they would kind of not even get to the point of applying. So, yeah, that was a pretty interesting thing to report.
You spoke with about a dozen gunshot victims for this piece. You know, there's so much attention right now on the AR-15. What kind of gun was used when you spoke with these people who were shot?
You know, that's a great question. I don't generally ask that. Hmm. I know that's kind of weird. I mean, I am usually more interested in, like, the from the hospital on. So what happened to you? You know, what resources were given to you at the hospital, what happened after you left, how long did you have to be in physical therapy, did you have an interest in talking to a counselor? Those are the questions I'm normally asking people. We know that most gun violence in America is perpetrated with handguns.
Right.
That's just from research, but...
No, you know, that's why I asked, because it's incredible. It's this conversations on the AR-15, but it's the gun. I mean, it's the gun that's shooting people, hurting people, as you wrote about. And I mean, you've got so many incredible stories. One of them is about Ernest Edmonds Jr. On December 13th, 2015, he was leaving a club in Newark when he says a man asked him for a cigarette. The man tried to rob him. When he fought back, he heard a loud crack and then saw red blooming through the stripes of his baseball jersey. He then blacked out. He woke up in a hospital, he was in a coma for several weeks. He's only 35, and he's now paralyzed from the waist down. The bullet pierced his back, and it was stopped by his spine.
Yeah, Ernest was somebody that I got in touch with through a local anti-violence activist in the Newark area. And I talked with him over a period of months because he knew about victim compensation, and he had already tried to apply for it one time, but it didn't succeed. So he was on his second round of trying to apply. And so I was basically just check in with him every few weeks and ask about any progress. But the things that he, you know, small hurdles that you wouldn't necessarily think of that really kept the process from moving forward for him. And, you know, he wasn't even, the police report didn't even have his name on it. He was a John Doe. Like, nobody knew who he was when he was brought to the hospital, I guess because his wallet was stolen after he was shot. So even obtaining the police report was not, you know, an easy thing. And that is something that you need generally to apply for compensation. Mm-hmm. So he is still waiting, I think.
He used to work in construction. Now he has to rely on a $766 monthly disability check. That is Elizabeth Van Brocklink. She's a staff reporter at The Trace, an independent nonprofit news organization dedicated to expanding coverage of guns in the United States. Now I would like to welcome Chuck Rabin to the show. Chuck is a reporter covering cops and crime at the Miami Herald. Hi, Chuck. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thank you. You have written a number of stories this week, obviously, about the shooting. We've just been talking with Elizabeth about all of the different angles. I mean, there's so much attention on the AR-15. We just got word that Governor Rick Scott in Florida wants to increase the age limit to 21 from 18.
Right.
But it's not just AR-15s. I mean, as Elizabeth reports, so much gun violence is used with handguns. I mean, the majority of people use handguns. What are your thoughts, Chuck, about other angles that journalists should be pursuing? What other angles are you pursuing?
I think the handgun thing, it's a decent point, but I mean, you can obviously do a lot more damage with an AR-15 or, you know, rifles that fire with large magazines and a handgun. So it's definitely going to save lives if you can't, you know, make those purchases. As far as other angles, we're looking into, you know, the reaction of the Broward County Sheriff's Office to the incident and how the feds responded to it. You know, there were obviously a lot of signals that were missed that police and law enforcement should have caught on to early.
Can you talk more about that? What are you hearing right now from police and law enforcement in Florida?
There were, I believe, 23 calls, into the Broward Sheriff's Office just on Cruz himself. Some from out of town, but they were calls directly. There were at least two that they're looking into now, in which people said that, you know, he was threatening to shoot schools or could become a school shooter, and they named him directly.
You know, Chuck, how do you think the media should report on these issues? I mean, CNN had a headline on Tuesday. There have been at least 20 incidents involving threats and weapons at schools since the Florida shooting. I mean, this is just a long list. Spartanburg, South Carolina, a ninth grade student was arrested February 15th after posting a threat on Snapchat. Arlington, Texas, a 13-year-old boy was arrested at a junior high after telling students he wanted to shoot up the school. I mean, we're talking about 13-year-olds? You know,
yeah, I mean, there's a difference here. Apparently, I don't know the laws in those other states. The Broward sheriff is actually claiming that they're kind of handcuffed because unless it's an absolutely specific threat, he doesn't think he can actually take people into custody. So, in those situations, I think that, you know, the kids would have been, you know, talked to and given back to their parents. I believe he says if you make a specific threat, you know, if you name the school, if you say the person that you're intend to go after, then you can take a person into custody and take their weapons.
You've been covering crime for 30 years, and now we have social media. I mean, how are authorities going to deal with these kinds of comments that we see on, you know, YouTube and Snapchat? I mean, you obviously, there's got to be a conversation about how these things should be dealt with. What are your thoughts as someone who's been covering crime for three decades?
That's true. It makes it more difficult in a lot of ways. It's a new frontier, right? I mean, when things start out new, they're messy. So you move on. You try to deal with them the best you can, and you adjust as you realize how things work. I mean, we don't even know. Laws are all scattered about how to deal with things over social media and the internet. Is it a bad thing? I mean, it does a lot of good too, right? So it's just something that has to be adjusted to, and it's a very tricky thing for law enforcement. In a lot of cases, they solve crimes using social media. So it's here or there.
What are your thoughts, Elizabeth? Unfortunately, I mean, this is just going to continue. We're just getting word that two people were injured in a shooting on the campus of Southeastern Louisiana University just last night. Elizabeth?
You know, yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, so what are your thoughts about how this is going to be covered from here on out, especially in light of what we're hearing is happening across the country with other incidents?
I'm not sure how it's going to be covered differently. I mean, you know, perhaps these students have started this movement, so I'll be curious to see if it keeps happening at other schools. There was an NPR piece that I was listening to yesterday where they were interviewing two students who had been present at other school shootings. They said they were interested in joining this movement. They would love to be part of it. So I'm not sure how the coverage will change, but I think that you'll continue to hear as there is more coverage, our continued coverage of Parkland, other journalists who, you know, like the one I mentioned, the Baltimore Sun, and in Chicago and other cities, and even where Chuck is, that there's an ongoing, you know, violence that is affecting young people and has been for a really long time. So perhaps that will, they'll have some relation to each other and bring more light to that too.
We have an email from Renee who says, the young people's voices are inspiring and give me hope for our future during these dark days. Many are or will be of voting age before long and can have great impact on future elections. I hope they exercise this responsibility as they continue their direct actions. Chuck, we were talking about the fact that on the front page of the New York Times, there's a piece called Why This Gun Debate is Different from the Rest because of the student activism that we've seen. What strikes you about that and how they've been able to really change the conversation?
Well, I mean, it's 100% accurate, right? I mean, when Columbine was hit, it was something new, right? No one knew that this was going to turn into, I don't want to call it a trend, but that other schools were going to be shot up and whatever. Sandy Hook was children. This is really the first instance where you're at a school with a bunch of well-to-do kids that have the resources to get done what they need, who have terrific voices, and they believe in a cause. And I think you know, the former president even said something the other night about how all movements begin with, you know, youth. And maybe this will change some things.
Hmm. And what struck you about the CNN town hall where these young people were pointedly asking politicians, especially Marco Rubio, about whether he will stop taking money from the NRA?
How composed they were. Hmm. You know, the intelligence of the questions. And they're, you know, it's not easy to stand in front of large groups of people and keep your composure, right? I mean, we know that. But these kids, they grew up in a different place, right? They see themselves on their phones and they talk to each other, so they're always on camera, and they looked pretty good on camera.
Mm. And Chuck, as someone who's covered crime for the last 30 years, What are you looking for right now? I mean, what is it like to cover these shootings, you know, day in and day out?
Well, I cover normal crime. This isn't really particularly normal. So it's not like every day I'm facing 17 kids and teachers who are killed at a, you know, at a high school. It's what I signed up for, right? I cover crime and events that affect people. So I'll just keep doing it the way I've always done it.
Hmm. What about you, Elizabeth?
What am I looking for?
If I'm in tears reading the articles that you have written about, I mean, you have interviewed other journalists who cover crime to find out how they cope and what they're looking for. What about you? How do you cope? I mean, you're talking with people who have been shot and are now paralyzed, who are struggling to get the health care and the therapy that they need.
Yes, I actually interviewed Chuck. Hi, Chuck. A couple of years ago, and I asked him the same question, which was, "How do you do this?" So this is a fun to be on this conversation with him. I'm just figuring it out. I don't really have great answers, but I do like to talk to other journalists who cover these things or have covered them for a long time. And it's helpful to just talk to other people because you hear that they have the same struggles and that it doesn't feel so strange, if something is upsetting. But I try to, like, pay attention to my coworkers and also myself, and, you know, if I need a break, I might need a break.
And what are you working on right now, Elizabeth?
Right now I'm doing more projects that have to do with, gunshot survivors. And I am also going to start looking at a pretty interesting, I guess, experiment or practice in Philadelphia where cops can basically take gunshot survivors to the hospital before, you know, without waiting for ambulances to come.
Wow.
So I'm going to be looking at that moment right after somebody is shot and see how quickly they get help.
Wow. What about you, Chuck? What are you working on right now?
I'm just covering Parkland right now. That's what I'm doing. But, in answer to what you said previously, I don't think I understood you perfectly. It's upsetting and it's emotional, and it is, and it feels particularly close to home this time. I mean, everybody knows people involved somehow through connections, and you get to know the kids and the families. And typically we detach ourselves, otherwise you wouldn't be able to get the work done. But I mean, you go home, you sit down, you have a drink, sometimes you cry. I mean, we're normal human beings.
Mm. Well, thank you for joining us. Thank you for your reporting. Chuck Rabin is a reporter covering cops and crime at the Miami Herald, and he's been covering the Parkland shooting all week. Elizabeth Van Brocklink is a staff reporter at The Trace, a nonprofit news organization dedicated to expanding coverage of guns in the United States. She and her colleagues give a voice to so many gun victims who are survivors of gun violence, who are not getting the funds that they desperately need for health care and therapy. Chuck and Elizabeth, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much. Bye, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us. It's your call.